Hi, I'm Dr. Akiva Down.
And I'm Rabbi Avi Green.
And welcome to Interesting Questions.
In this podcast, we'll be addressing issues that are philosophical, religious, and psychological in nature.
We will be focusing on that which is considered to be controversial, and there may not be a right or wrong answer. So we are hoping that our discussions will yield more questions for your Shabbos table.
Welcome to a Thursday episode of Interesting Questions. Vayhi bimei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh, haholech mehodu v'yad kush. If you haven't gotten it yet, we are going to be doing Megillat Esther, because coming up, if you're listening to this today, it is Ta'anit Esther, it is the fast of Esther, and on Sunday it will be Purim Day. And so we thought it would be fun and interesting to talk a little bit about some of the figures in the Megillah and do a little bit of analyzing of who they were and might have been and why they might have done the things that they did. And so I'm going to start off with Achashverosh. And I had some insights listening to a friend of mine, Shlomo Sprung. He has a Sprung on Torah podcast, if you want to go and listen there. He has a multi-part series on the Megillah. And one of the things he talked about was the idea of, is Achashverosh a bad guy, a stupid guy, or neither of the above? And so I want to propose, right, one of the things that seems clear from the story of Purim is that Achashverosh was not of royal descent. He was somebody who had held another job, and the Gemara suggests that he was a stable hand, and that Vashti, who was the princess, really wanted to marry him to embarrass her father, who was the king. And so Achashverosh became the king. But really, he was an ignoramus who was a stable hand. I would like to suggest an alternative based a little bit on some historical reading I've done, but also based on the words of the Megillah, which was that Achashverosh had been a military leader. We might call him a general. I don't know what rank he would have had, but he would have been a military leader. And part of the reason, right, first of all, Achashverosh, we should know, is not probably not his name, but just like we talk about the pharaohs of Egypt, Achashverosh would have been his title, right? And therefore, he was this military leader, and the reason that it points out that he had these 127 countries from Hodu to Kush is because he was responsible as the military leader for helping to take over that much territory, and that was part of why he was able to become the king of this land. We also know that because previously it was run by the Babylonians, that they did not allow people to worship in their own way. Everybody had to follow Zoroastrianism. And they did not allow people, right, they wanted everybody in lockstep in terms of the things that were required of them. And therefore, one of the things that Achashverosh is big on is everybody gets to do their own thing, right? It talks about the party. You could choose to drink as much or as little as you wanted. You got to live in the way that you wanted. In fact, if we later see that Achashverosh was the one, at least according to the Gemara, who allowed the Jews to go back and begin to prepare for the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And so this idea that, you know, he was a general who had seen things, who understood why people rebelled, seems to make a lot of sense, especially when you understand that he may have taken over power from the previous king through force. And therefore, when Bigtan and Teresh decide that they are going to come and attack him and overthrow him, and Mordechai saves him, right? It's something that makes him very nervous. And in fact, Esther is going to play on that nervous worry about somebody trying to overthrow him with Haman as well. And so I'm not sure I put Ahasuerus as either a dunce nor as a villain, but rather as somebody who has military knowledge, who is intelligent, but also has his foibles. Want to give us some insights, Akiva?
Sure. I was thinking as you were saying, I love the idea of him being a military leader, because I have to say it also then makes a lot more sense as far as the end of the Megillah, right? Where we know that Ahasuerus gave permission for the Yehudim to fight back. Some random dunce king giving you permission to fight back is not the same as potentially getting even strategical assistance, which could have been and may have not been elaborated on in a Megillah, from a military leader. I think it also, without suggesting that I know too much about any particular military leaders, because I'm not going to suggest that, I think that it goes along rather well with the idea of when you know what you're good at and you know where you fit, and you're put in a position where you have to fit somewhere else, you struggle. And I think in the beginning of the Megillah, where we see that Ahasuerus has to have all of these beautiful things and all of these, what I assume, because I'm also not a king, would be thought of as kingly possessions and kingly things, they make such a big deal about it. He said, oh, look what I have this, I have that. You want a gold cup? You could have a gold cup. You want a marble couch for some reason? Sit on a marble couch. And all these different things that we talked about, I remember we talked about previously, not very comfortable and not necessarily meaningful. And yet, I need to prove it, right? And I need to prove, look, I have this beautiful wife and she'll show herself in front of everybody, because you have to see, I'm the biggest, I'm the best. Because if you know how to show that as a military leader, then you don't necessarily know how to show it as a political leader, and certainly as a king. And so I think I agree with this idea of not that he was a dunce, or that he was evil, but rather that he was worldly in an area and very much didn't fit in other areas. And I think that's where we see, and that's why we think of perhaps some of these pieces of villainous activity, right? Because again, when you don't know how to be king, you try and surround yourself with people, presumably, who will guide you in the right direction. But if you don't know how to be king and you don't know how to get the advice, you don't necessarily know who's good to give you the advice. So maybe you have someone like Haman, who becomes this trusted advisor, but is in it for themselves, and isn't in it for your growth, and isn't in it to teach you how to be more effective. You know, it's not like, it's the equivalent almost of if you are going to be one of the head rebbeim, you would surround yourself with other rebbeim, with other gedolim, to know how can I do this? How can I be the best? How can I make sure that I'm doing what's best for the community? But if you were the butcher and they made you the head of the rabbinate, for I don't know why, but you may think, okay, these guys know what they're talking about, but how would you know? And I think that's a very important question on the judge of character and all of those aspects. And I would say, and I would certainly argue that perhaps what we can say, I think, pretty evenly about Ahasuerus is that I don't know that he was a great judge of character. And that's probably why he both made sure to try and prevent himself from being overthrown by letting people do relatively what they wanted, also behaved in a way that he thought a king was supposed to behave, even though it probably was not how a king should behave, and was willing to take advice from people that he perhaps didn't know how to vet properly.
So I'm going to suggest we move on to Vashti. And while we don't see a lot of her, if we talk about what we do know, then continuing with the idea that Ahasuerus was not royal born, then his way of becoming king was to marry into the kingship or the royal family, and that would mean Vashti. And Vashti, you know, seems to go along with this role to a certain extent. You know, she may feel like she has to keep up appearances. I'm sure she was, as the queen, as the royal daughter, she was taught certain things about how one behaves in the royal court and things that happen. And therefore, when her husband is entertaining the male guests, she entertains the female guests. And she seems fine participating in this part. And it isn't until her husband calls for her to show up that she seems to have a problem. And again, it's not clear whether that problem is with the husband because for whatever reason that marriage is strained, or if it's because of the way he does it or the specific timing or whatever it might be. The other thing that to me is interesting about Vashti is that when we look at what they suggest is done to her after she refuses to listen to the king, right? The advisors seem to be in a catch-22 because at this point Ahasuerus is quite drunk. And they're worried that on the one hand, if they don't recommend he do anything to her, then he might chop off their heads right then and there. After all, he is a man of action. And if they suggest that he do something to her, then he might regret it once he's sober and again take it out on them. And so one person seems to have the thoughtfulness and advice to say, well, we simply banish her. She can no longer show up in front of the king. And that has two advantages. One, it means if the king changes his mind, in theory, he could bring her back. But two, it means his connection to the monarchy remains in place. She may never come before the king again. She may never be able to provide him with offspring, perhaps. But at the end of the day, he's still married to her, and he's still king by virtue of the fact that he married her. And so that balance between, you know, we're going to banish her, but we're not going to kill her, seems to be an important role there. More to add, Akiva?
You know, I think it's fascinating. Your goal was to talk about Vashti, and you really, again, started talking about Ahasuerus. And I think that speaks very, very highly of the fact of we don't really know a lot about Vashti. Certainly I don't. I will own that, but I'm going to guess that, Avi, I trust your level of knowledge, and you're nodding your head yes, so I'm going to say, yeah, we don't know a lot about Vashti. And I think that just the ideas that come to my mind are that I don't think that they necessarily got along. I don't think they had a healthy marriage. And, you know, I know that it's Right, we think it's a new custom, a new concept, the idea of love within marriage. And yet at the same time, we also acknowledge that there are things that exist like Stockholm Syndrome and, just basic tenets of what does it mean to have love that were defined based off of the things that happen within a relationship, regardless of whether it was the first and foremost piece of importance, right? So maybe at the time, maybe Vashti, of course, it wasn't a question of does Achashverosh love Vashti, right? Not a question. She's the princess or the queen, and he wants to be king, so he marries her. Doesn't matter if he loves her. Well, okay, fine. If they were in a what we would consider to be any semblance of a marriage that was looking for growth, I don't think it's very possible to have a growth in that relationship without some development of what we would at some point define as love. Meaning, if you want to continue your line and have, then you have offspring. Okay, we raise those kids. There's not really a question generally, right? There's not a question, well, marriage, is that, was that love? Was that necessity? Was that you watch my back, I'll watch yours, or you provide for me and I'll cook for you, whatever it is. But offspring, we don't really question, we're offspring loved. Well, I think so. I think that that's, when we have offspring, we care for them. And again, caring for something to a certain extent is the definition of loving them. So you have offspring. You share that. There's a love there. There's a connection there. There's a growth within the value of the relationship beyond just, you're the queen, I want to be king, I'm getting married. And I think when you look at the relationship of Vashti and Achashverosh, I think you probably, as we were saying, have something that consists of, I'll put up with you because I don't want to die, but I don't want to be around you. I don't like you. I don't want to be near you, and I'm not going to tolerate it. So when you behave and let me behave like a queen, then I'll behave like a queen. But when you ask me to behave like anything other than a queen, I'm not going to do that. And I think that's what we see very clearly from Vashti, is she's not willing to lower herself to what some general says, you should do this because I'm the king. That's not what she does. And yeah, then what happens? She disappears, or is banished, or goes to a dungeon, or
whatever it might be.
And so I think that that's probably a pretty valued summary, because I think also we see, again, if this was a healthy marriage, if this was a marriage with one that you saw mutual care or even any kind of respect, Achashverosh being a military leader and knowing I want to be king, I want to stay king, I want to know what to do, because I think we do see that in him, he would have said to his queen, how do I do this? He doesn't do that. And we don't have any indication that she tells him how to do that other than saying, I'm not doing this, this is inappropriate, and him responding with, what do I do?
And so I think that takes us to Haman. And if we look at Haman, you alluded to it earlier, Akiva, the idea that he was the typical guy who wants to get ahead no matter what the cost is. I'm going to get in the good graces of whoever's in charge. I'm going to kiss their tuchus until I get what I want and get mine. There are suggestions in the Gemara that he was quite wealthy, because at one point when he offers to kill the Jews, and the king says, well, there would be a loss in finances because of that, and he says, I'll put it into the treasury, don't worry, right? And so the Gemara suggests that wasn't even his money, that was his wife's money. But he sort of catches himself in a dilemma, in the sense that there's two things that he wants, and they seem to be almost mutually exclusive. He wants to be the second most important person, or maybe the most important person, in the kingdom next to the king. And so you look at all of the things that he enacts, right? The idea that he enacts that people have to bow down to him. The idea that, and this happens in the courtyard of the king, where you'd think you'd only bow down to the king. And so he's saying, no, 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 I am the representative of the king, and therefore you bow down to me just as you would to the king, because I am representing the king in this. And the second is his desire to wipe out the Jewish people. And if he had just chosen one, he might have fully been successful. And it was his desire to do both. And again, if we're looking at examples of when is it that he tries to put himself first and foremost, when the king says, how would we reward somebody who has done something for the king? And the one line where we really get inside Haman's head is, right, where he says, who would the king want to reward more than me? And then he goes about talking about how you should dress in the clothing of the king and ride the king's horse and have someone walk around and say, this is how the king rewards someone. And so in this way, we see that Haman is really focused on being well-known, being popular, being, again, controlling. And he was very smart. Let us not think that Haman was not smart. Haman was smart. And if we want one proof of that, it says in the Megillah that when Haman was deciding what day the Jews should be killed, he decides the day, and then he decides the month. And the Gemara asks, why would you decide the day and then the month? Usually it's the other way around. You decide what month, and then you decide what day. The problem was, he rolled the lots, whether they were dice or some sort of lottery, and it comes up as the next day. Well, he's very efficient, but he's not that efficient. He can't go around and kill everybody tomorrow. So he needs to find a way to, he needs to pick a month. And so then he does the lottery again, because if you're going to start with a lottery, you have to continue with the lottery. And it comes up 12 months later. So he now has to wait a whole year. And it is interesting, because you would think that that would make him very sad, but instead, it makes him happy, because he now has time to plan, and he now has time to put things into place, and to manipulate the king, and to use this to his advantage. He's not just about to go kill one person. If he just killed Mordechai because Mordechai didn't bow down to him, it would seem petty. There's this one guy, and he won't do what I want, so I'm going to kill him. No. Let me get rid of his people. Let me get rid of everybody who's like him. And that's because of who Mordechai was. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think that this is who Haman was, right? He was the person who was trying to get ahead by any means necessary. And he was somebody who hated Mordechai and the Jewish people. Thoughts on that, Akiva?
I was actually thinking a lot about your mentioning that it may have been Zeresh's money, not Haman's. And it kind of really brings up the idea that Purim is a holiday, a celebration of powerful women. Powerful women, in one way or another, being put into positions that are uncomfortable or difficult or challenging by lesser men. And rising to the occasion? Why do I say that? Because, right, all we've talked about so far is Vashti, Achashverosh, and Haman, and not even so much Zeresh, but we'll start with Zeresh, right? So if she has the money, then here she is. You mentioned, and I agree with what you said about Haman being this wannabe, someone with a very weak ego. No ego strength, right? This is the classic idea of when we use the term narcissist, right? A narcissist is the reason why also we have that, right? We have that phrase, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, which I think on the surface, okay, that makes sense, but I think many of us don't necessarily understand the full depth of that statement. And the idea is that if you don't have a lot of significant ego strength, a lot of sense of self, knowing who you are and knowing and being okay with that, then you develop this thin shield, which seems to be very strong. Glass seems to be very strong until you shatter it. And then you see how the whole thing crumbles. And this is what we see with people like Haman. Right? I'm so important, I'm so powerful, I'm so everything I can do. And yet, wait a minute, someone won't bow to me. I must be weak, I must be nothing, because one person won't bow. No, if you really are that strong, you don't care. Right? We've talked about this before. When you're over 50, you don't care anymore. And so Haman should not care if he was really as strong of and as powerful as he thought he was. But you have Zeresh standing behind him saying, this is what you do for this, and this is what you do for that, and this is how you handle this. And probably at some point, and I'll bankroll it, so don't worry, we have the money, honey. It'll be okay. Right? You can see all of that going on. You see this weak man coming home and saying, someone won't bow to me. Right? And then the wife builds him up, because what else is she going to do? She has to stand behind him because no one cares what she says directly, but she can hold the puppet strings. And then you have Achashverosh and Vashti. We've said, Achashverosh, I don't know how to be the king. Doesn't know how to be the king. Vashti tries to say, this is not what you do. He's too drunk to know. It's foolish, he can't figure it out. And I think that's a good description, by the way, because I think he's not stupid, he's foolish. Because a foolish man doesn't see their weaknesses. He saw his strengths, and he tried to use those to his advantage, and in many ways he did. But he was foolish in that he did not see his weaknesses. And when Vashti said, don't do this, it's not appropriate, he said, no, I'm right. Vashti, stronger than Achashverosh. And then, which we will get to, we have Esther, and I'm going to jump ahead and I'm going to say, Mordechai, he's a wonderful, wonderful man. And yet, what do we know about him otherwise? We know that he got his niece, or
whatever again, the relationship was.
Maybe niece, who knows? But he had her go and try and be the queen. He pushed her for that part. Right, she didn't say, oh, I think I want to try out for this beauty contest. And then she is the one who carries out all of the hard work, all of the labor, all of the... And I don't mean that by any sense other than literally. I think what she did was very difficult. And I think she persevered and she did it. And she is the one who we should be primarily crediting, because, okay, maybe Mordechai had more of the brains than certainly Haman and certainly Achashverosh. There's no question about that. So not maybe. He did. And at the same time, we see that Esther is really the one who also came up with a lot of these ideas, a lot of these ways to convince Achashverosh of what to do, to get the fool to listen. That takes a lot of special ability and success to be able to, we know at that time that you didn't necessarily see the king all the time if you were the queen, but she got him to see her multiple times in a row. She got him to do whatever she needed him to do. That takes skill. That takes a certain sense of power and strength and intelligence and tenacity. And we see Mordechai also at the end. You said, Avi, that maybe Achashverosh assisted with even helping our people to go back. But Mordechai doesn't go back. He stays because maybe it's easier to be a fish in that pond than to go and be a pioneer in another. Avi, thoughts about that?
Yeah, you just jumped right into Esther and Mordechai, so I'll do the same. I'll start with Esther. I think that the relationship between Mordechai and Esther is complicated, right? She's described as his relation, as his niece, and yet if the two of them are living together, it would almost seem as though they were married. And I think that may have had halachic ramifications. The one issue you said that I would take issue with is he puts her forward for this beauty contest. I don't know that he puts her forward. I think that basically the king calls for any woman who is deemed beautiful enough to be a queen, and she fits the bill. And so married or not, she's expected to go to the palace and partake in this role. And this would not be the first king that we're aware of who takes other people's wives, right? The idea of prima nocta, that the king or the ruler could have his way with a woman on the first night that she's married before anybody else does, is unfortunately something that had happened in many communities. And so, as you said, though, I think Esther is highly intelligent. She's highly capable. She, just as she comes in, she catches the eye of Harbona, and he gives her extra people, extra servants to help her prepare. And she has a year to prepare, to slough off the dirt and to prepare and to get into certain oils in order to smell good and to look queenly and to have soft skin for the king and all sorts of things. And so they have a year to prepare. And during this time, we know that Mordechai checks on her. And essentially, right, they would give each person whatever they wanted, each woman, before they were with the king, because what would happen is they would go from the house where they were before they slept with the king, they would go and sleep with the king, and then they'd go to a different house after they had slept with the king, and they would not return unless he called them. And so each woman was given whatever she asked for to take to the king. So if this one wanted feathers, or this one wanted something else, or this one suggested a third thing, right, they'd get whatever they asked for to take to the king to try to tickle his fancy. And when she goes, she really doesn't take anything with her. Just whatever they say that she should take. And that's what she goes with. Nothing fancy, nothing, right? And yet, she catches the king's attention. And perhaps that's why she catches the king's attention. Because she doesn't try to use all sorts of tools or things to interest him. And maybe it's because she doesn't even really want to be there. Because if she was married to Mordechai, then this isn't something she chooses. She doesn't hope to be the queen. Just the opposite. She hopes to not be chosen. And so the fact that she is not interested in him is the difference maker to him. Suddenly he has to try. Suddenly he has to be interested. It's not somebody who's overly trying to please him. And so this change in demeanor, this change in pace is part of what interests him. And as the years go on, again, she's not interested in a physical relationship with him. Until Mordechai comes to her and he says to her, you need to go talk to the king about what Haman has done, about the fact that he's going to kill our people. And she says, but he hasn't called for me in 30 days. He says, if it's not you, the Jewish people will still be saved, but you will not be. And so she says, okay, we'll fast for 3 days, and then I'll go. And so sure enough, she fasts for 3 days, right? Whether some have suggested that is in connection with wanting to look her best and lose a few pounds before she goes in, or not. You're giving me a strange look, Akiva.
Well, just because only, I really think primarily only in today's society do we value
being thin.
Or worse, yes. I think that in a time when every resource was very scarce, especially food, I think that we know from most cultures that having some meat on your bones meant that you were of good stock, not that you were less attractive.
Okay, and so she fasts for 3 days, and then she goes in. And what grabs Ahasuerus' attention? Why does he put out the scepter for her to touch? Because all of a sudden, in the past, it's been him calling her. She has never come to him. And now, he sees a change. She has come to him. And he recognizes that by saying, what is it that you want? I'll give you half the country. And she wisely says, I want a dinner with you and with me and with Haman. And I don't know that she has a fully baked plan. I think she's winging it a little bit. But the idea that she has come to the king, she will be with the king, and I think there's a halachic component that plays itself out here, which is as follows. When she meets, when she has this conversation with Mordechai through a third party, you know, if we make the assumption that Esther and Mordechai were married, and that he gave her a divorce, before she went to be with the king, then here's what happens. If she chooses to be with another man, she can never go back to her husband. But she can make the argument that all of these times that she has been with the king, we have to remember that the Purim story takes place over years. It's not a year, this is multiple years, but over the time she's been with the king until now, it's essentially been rape. She has not chosen to be with him. However, if she goes to the king, it is now her being the one who is proactive. And therefore, she would lose that opportunity to ever be with her husband again. And so she's hesitant to do so. And Mordechai has to assure her, this is what God wants. And so sure enough, she goes. And she has this sort of partial plan where she takes Haman and Ahasuerus and they have dinner together. And when the king asks her, tell me what it is you want. All she says is, let's do it again tomorrow night. And I think that's because she's looking for the opening. She's looking for the connection of that Ahasuerus will have with her over Haman. And she's not seeing it yet. He's still connected to Haman. He's still more on the side of his advisor than he is on the side of his wife. And so she has to stall for time. She has to wait. And then, on the second night, when Haman has had a very bad day, when the king has remembered what Mordechai has done for him, when she has come to him again of her own volition, she breaks the news to him. And even then, what does Ahasuerus do? He has to go out into the gardens for a walk to think about it. My best friend, the queen. He's not sure what to do until he returns and he finds that Haman has pled his case by sort of jumping on top of her and to beg for forgiveness and to beg for his life. And when he sees this, he loses it. Ahasuerus just loses it. And that's when Haman is killed. But I agree with you, Akiva, that Esther plays an incredibly strong role, very possibly stronger than Mordechai. Did you have more to say about Esther?
Just to talk a little bit more about the what I think might be interesting medical possibilities about the whole fasting for 3 days part is I don't know that it was necessarily the idea of, you know, the new age idea of a fad diet, but rather maybe some of that, some of those small amounts of, I don't know, hidden or not, but right, we talk about the nace, and part of, I think, the nace is, you know, you've been fasting for 3 days. Many of us who fast one day don't look so great at the end. And here we have the queen, Esther, who fasts for 3 days and then goes to see the king and says, hey, I'd like to spend some time with you. And the fact that he takes interest, I think, in part, really speaks to maybe some of the spiritual nace of this whole aspect. Because I don't think that it's something where she probably... I don't think she went as her best. I think she was far from her best having fasted for 3 days. And I also will point out that, you know, many of us have also experienced as that fast ends, your body eventually starts to shoot out extra dopamine to compensate for how to tolerate that fast. And it's possible that she was a little loopy too, because she may have been not only having significantly low blood sugar at that time, but also she may have had a little bit of extra dopamine floating around trying to help her to get through the fast. That's just some things that I were thinking about that I was thinking about when you were talking about. But I think that all fits really. It gives us a nice deeper dive into who are the players, and you know, maybe ultimately to kind of get the idea that it's nice every once in a while that we have part of our a major part of our practice that really does showcase the importance of both, well, the importance of women, quite frankly, because I think that we do, like many patriarchal religions, we do a really good job at showcasing the importance of the men. And I think we do better than some, per se, in showcasing the importance of women, but I think this is a nice opportunity to showcase not only the importance of women within our practice, but also the importance of a healthy relationship and what an unhealthy relationship can lead to. I think those are all important aspects that we can certainly take away from the Nace of Purim as well.
So I think that takes us to our last figure of the Megillah, Mordechai. And I think that Mordechai, in some ways, while we all think of him as the hero of the story, in some ways is actually one of the minor characters in the fact that he is really known as Ish Yehudi. And so he is a leader of the Jewish people. And Akiva, when you mentioned earlier that he, you know, he doesn't go back to Jerusalem, I think that's because as leader, he says, I go where I'm needed and I stay here, right? And even when he makes certain decisions about telling Esther to hide who she is, right? He's doing it from a leadership position. He could have easily told her, no, as soon as they take you, just tell them you're Jewish, and, well, either they'll kill you or they'll set you free, right? But instead, he plays the long game, so to speak, and he's very careful about what he does and who he stands up to, right? He helps the king, but he stands up to Haman. And so I think this is an interesting insight into who Mordechai was. Maybe there's more to look at. Maybe that'll be for another year. But I'll give you the last word on Mordechai, and then we'll wrap up what has been a longer than usual podcast for us.
I guess the only piece that I would really kind of suggest is, you know, when you mentioned that he is Ish Yehudi, and in that, okay, so okay, he has a leadership role within the community, and people see him as an important man to look to, which might be why a little bit it's extra biting that he didn't bow to Haman in Haman's eyes. At the same time, he may also be an example of what a prototypical Jew should be. And the idea of, well, we should hold true to our beliefs. We should be leaders within our community, which also means being respectful and assistive to all of the parts of our community, which would be, well, I can hold true to my beliefs by not bowing to people when I feel that's not appropriate to do, and at the same time, I can be mindful of the monarchy or the government and show my respect there. I think another aspect is he doesn't hide from what's going on around him. Further, and probably most importantly, if he is Esther's wife, or sorry, Esther's husband, he stands behind her, and he supports her, and he does what she needs for him to do. And I think that that's, again, part of the importance of that healthy marriage, that healthy relationship, is that even when things aren't working, or when things are forced to not be working, we have the necessary opportunity to support and stand with our spouses and to be a partner. And I think that in those ways, Ish Yehudi is a way of saying it's important for us to stand up and to support.
And so to finish up, your question for around your Purim table is, what do you appreciate most about a woman in your life?
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to reach us, you can reach us at iqdiscuss@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you and responding.